Right, said Vimes. Let's start again. He picked up an imaginary ladle. I'm the cook. I've made this nourishing gruel that tastes like dog's water. I'm filling up three bowls. Everyone's watching me. All the bowls have been well washed, right? Okay. The tasters take two, one to taste, and these days the other's for Little Bottom to check, and then a servant, that's you, Carrot, takes the third one and puts it in the dumbwaiter, sir. There's one up to every room. I thought they carried them up. 6 floors, it'd get stone cold, sir. All right, hold on, we've gone too far. You've got the bowl, do you put it on a tray? Yes, sir. Put it on a tray, then. Carrot obediently put the invisible bowl on an invisible tray. Anything else? Said Vimes. Piece of bread, sir, and we check the loaf. Soup spoon? Yes, sir. Well, don't just stand there, put them on. Carrot detached one hand from the invisible tray to take an invisible piece of bread and an intangible spoon. Anything else? Said Vimes. Salt and pepper? I think I remember salt and pepper pots, sir. On they go, then. Vimes stared, hawk-like, at the space between Carrot's hands. No, he said. We wouldn't have missed that, would we? I mean, we wouldn't, would we? He reached out and picked up an invisible tube. Tell me we've checked the salt, he said. That's the pepper, sir, said Carrot, helpfully. Salt, mustard, vinegar, pepper, said Vimes. We didn't check all the food and then let his lordship tip poison on to suit his taste, did we? Arsenic's a metal. Can't you get metal salts? Tell me we asked ourselves that. We aren't that stupid, are we? I'll check directly, said Carrot. He looked around desperately. I'll just put the tray down. Not yet, said Vimes. I've been here before. We don't rush off shouting, give me a towel, just because we've had one idea. Let's keep looking, shall we? The spoon, what's it made of? Good point. I'll check the cutlery, sir. Now we're cooking with charcoal. What's he been drinking?
Boiled water, sir. We've tested the water and I checked the glasses.
Good. So, we've got the tray, and you put the tray in the dumb waiter, and then what?
The men in the kitchen haul on the ropes and it goes up to the 6th floor.
No stops?
Carrot looked blank.
It goes up 6 floors, said Vimes. It's just a shaft with a big box in it that can be pulled up and down, isn't it? I'll bet there's a door into it on every floor.
Some of the floors are hardly used these days, sir.
Even better for our poisoner, hmm? He just stands there, bold as you like, and waits for the tray to come by, right? We don't know that the meal which arrives is the one that left, do we?
Brilliant, sir.
It happens at night, I'll swear, said Vimes. He's chipper in the evenings and out like a light next morning. What time is his supper sent up?
While he's poorly, around 6 o'clock, sir, said Carrot. It's got dark by then. Then he gets on with his writing.
Right. We've got a lot to do. Come on.
The patrician was sitting up in bed reading when Vimes entered.
Ah, Vimes, he said. Your supper will be up shortly, my lord, said Vimes, and can I once again say that our job would be a lot easier if you let us move you out of the palace?
I'm sure it would be, said Lord Vetinari.
There was a rattle from the dumb waiter. Vimes walked across and opened the doors. There was a dwarf in the box. He had a knife between his teeth and an axe in each hand and was glowering with ferocious concentration.
"Good heavens," said Vetinari weakly. "I hope at least they've included some mustard."
"Any problems, Constable?" said Vimes.
"No, sir," said the dwarf, unfolding himself and removing the knife. "Very dull all the way up, sir. There was other doors, and they all looked pretty unused, but I nailed them up anyway, like Captain Carrot said, sir."
"Well done. Down you go."
Vimes shut the doors. There was more rattling as the dwarf began its descent.
"Every detail covered, eh, Vimes?"
I hope so, sir.
The box came up again with a tray in it. Vimes took it out.
What's this?
A Clachian Hots without anchovies, said Vimes, lifting the cover. We got it from Ron's pizza hovel round the corner. The way I see it, no one can poison all the food in the city, and the cutlery's from my place.
You have the mind of a true policeman, Vimes.
Thank you, sir.
Really? Was it a compliment?
The patrician prodded at the plate with the air of an explorer in a strange country.
"Has someone already eaten this, Vimes?"
"No, sir, that's just how they chop up the food."
"Oh, I see. I thought perhaps the food tasters were getting over-enthusiastic."
said the patrician. "My word, what a treat I have to look forward to."
"I could see you're feeling a lot better, sir," said Vimes, stiffly.
"Thank you, Vimes." When Vimes had gone, Lord Vetinari ate the pizza, or at least those parts of it he thought he could recognise. Then he put the tray aside and blew out the candle by his bed. He sat in the dark for a while, then felt under his pillow until his finger located a small sharp knife and a box of matches. Thank goodness for Vimes. There was something endearing about his desperate, burning, and above all, misplaced competence. If the poor man took any longer, he'd have to start giving him hints. In the main office, Carrot sat alone, watching Dorful. The golem stood where it had been left. Someone had hung a dishcloth on one arm. The top of its head was still open. Carrot spent a while with his chin on one hand, just staring. Then he opened a desk drawer and took out Dorful's chem. He examined it. He got up. He walked over to the golem. He placed the words in the head. An orange glow rose in Dorful's eyes. What was baked pottery took on that faintest of auras that marked the change between the living and the dead. Carrot found the golem's slate and pencil and pushed them into Dorful's hand, then stood back. The burning gaze followed him as he removed his sword belt, undid his breastplate, took off his jerkin, and pulled his woolen vest over his head. The glow was reflected from his muscles. They glistened in the candlelight.
"No weapons," said Carrot, "no armour. You see? Now, listen to me."
Dorful lurched forward and swung a fist. Carrot did not move. The fist stopped a hair's breadth from Carrot's unblinking eyes.
"I didn't think you could," he said, as the golem swung again and the fist jerked to a stop a fraction of an inch from Carrot's stomach. "But sooner or later you'll have to talk to me. Right, anyway."
Dorful paused. Then it picked up the slate pencil.
"Take my words. Tell me about the golem who killed people."
The pencil did not move.
"The others have killed themselves," said Carrot. "I know." "How do you know?"
The golem watched him. Then it wrote,
"Clay of my clay."
"You feel what other golems feel," said Carrot. Dorful nodded.
"And people are killing golems," said Carrot. "I don't know if I can stop that, but I can try. I think I know what's happening, Dorful, some of it. I think I know who you are following, clay of your clay, shaming you all. Something went wrong. You tried to put it right. I think you all had such hopes. But the words in your head'll defeat you every time."
The golem stayed motionless.
"You sold him, didn't you?" said Carrot quietly. "Why?"
The words were scribbled quickly.
"Golem must have a master."
"Why? Because the words say so?
Golem must have a master."
Carrot sighed. Men had to breathe, fish had to swim. Golems had to have a master.
"I don't know if I can sort this out, but no one else is going to try, believe me," he said.
Dorful did not move. Carrot went back to where he'd been standing. "I'm wondering if the old priest and Mr. Hopkinson did something, or helped to do something," he said, watching the golem's face. "I'm wondering if afterwards something turned against them, found the world a bit too much."
Dorful remained impassive.
Carrot nodded. "Anyway, you're free to go. What happens now is up to you. I'll help you if I can. If a golem is a thing, then it can't commit murder. And I'll still try to find out why all this is happening. If a golem can commit murder, then you are people, and what is being done to you is terrible and must be stopped. Either way, you win, Dorful."
He turned his back and fiddled with some papers on his desk. "The big trouble," he added, "is that everyone wants someone else to read their minds for them and then make the world work properly. Even golems, perhaps."
He turned back to face the golem. "I know you've all got a secret, but the way things are going, there won't be any of you left to keep it." He looked hopefully at Dorful.
"No, clay of my clay, I will not betray."
Carrot sighed. "Well, I won't force you," he grinned, "although you know I could. I could write a few extra words on your chem, tell you to be talkative." The fires rose in Dorful's eyes. "But I won't, because that would be inhumane. You haven't murdered anyone, I can't deprive you of your freedom because you haven't got any. Go on, you can go. It's not as if I don't know where you live. To work is to live.
What is it golems want, Dorful?
I've seen you golems walking around the streets and working all the time, but what is it you actually hope to achieve?
The slate pencil scribbled.
Respite.
Then Dorful turned around and walked out of the building.
Damn, said Carrot,
a difficult linguistic feat. He drummed his fingers on the desk, then got up abruptly, put his clothing back on, and stalked down the corridor to find Angua. She was leaning against the wall in Corporal Littlebottom's office, talking to the dwarf.
I've sent Dorful home, said Carrot.
Has he got one? Said Angua.
Well, back to the slaughterhouse, anyway, but it's probably not a good time for a golem to be out alone, so I'm just going to stroll along after him and keep...
Are you all right, Corporal Littlebottom?
Yes, sir, said Cherry.
You're wearing,
Carrot's mind rebelled at the thought of what the dwarf was wearing and settled for...
Kilt?
Yes, sir. A skirt, sir. A leather one, sir.
Carrot tried to find a suitable response and had to resort to...
Oh. I'll come with you, said Angua. Cherry can keep an eye on the desk.
A kilt? Said Carrot.
Oh, well, just keep an eye on things. We won't be long, and, just keep behind the desk, all right?
Come on, said Angua.
When they were out in the fog, Carrot said, Do you think there's something a bit odd about Littlebottom?
Seems like a perfectly ordinary female to me, said Angua.
Female? He told you he was female?
She, Angua corrected. This is Ankh-Morpork, you know. We've got extra pronouns here. She could smell his bewilderment. Of course, everyone knew that somewhere down under all those layers of leather and chainmail, dwarfs came in enough different types to ensure the future production of more dwarfs. But it was not a subject that dwarfs discussed, other than at those essential points in a courtship when embarrassment might otherwise arise.
Well, I would have thought she'd have the decency to keep it to herself, Carrot said finally. I mean, I've nothing against females. I'm pretty certain my stepmother is one. But I don't think he's very clever, you know, to go around drawing attention to the fact.
Carrot, I think you've got something wrong with your head, said Angua.
What?
I think you may have got it stuck up your bum.
I mean, good grief, a bit of makeup and a dress, and you're acting as though she'd become Miss Va-Va-Voom and started dancing on tables down at the Skunk Club.
There were a few seconds of shocked silence while they both considered the image of a dwarfish striptease dancer. Both minds rebelled.
Anyway, said Angua, if people can't be themselves in Ankh-Morpork, where can they?
There'll be trouble when the other dwarfs notice, said Carrot. I could almost see his knees, her knees.
Everyone's got knees.
Perhaps, but it's asking for trouble to flaunt them.
I mean, I'm used to knees. I can look at knees and think, oh yes, knees, they're just hinges in your legs. But some of the lads...
Angua sniffed. He turned left here. Some of the lads what?
Well, I don't know how they'll react, that's all.
You shouldn't have encouraged her. I mean, of course there's female dwarfs, but, I mean, they have the decency not to show it.
He heard Angua gasp. Her voice sounded rather far away when she said, Carrot, you know, I've always respected your attitude to the citizens of Ankh-Morpork.
Yes?
I've been impressed by the way you really seem to be blind to things like shape and colour.
Yes?
And you always seem to care for people.
Yes?
And you know that I feel considerable affection for you.
Yes?
It's just that sometimes...
Yes?
I really, really, really wonder why.
Carriages were thickly parked outside Lady Selachi's mansion when Corporal Nobbs strolled up the drive. He knocked on the door. A footman opened it.
Servants' entrance, said the footman, and made to shut the door again.
But Nobby's outstretched foot had been ready for this.
Read these, he said, thrusting two bits of paper at him.
The first one read,
I, after hearing evidence from a number of experts, including Mrs. Slipdry, the midwife, certify that the balance of probability is that the bearer of this document, C.W. St. John Nobbs, is a human being. Signed, Lord Veterinary.
The other was the letter from Dragon, King of Arms. The footman's eyes widened.
"Oh, I am terribly sorry, your lordship," he said.
He stared again at Corporal Nobbs. Nobby was clean-shaven. At least the last time he'd shaved he'd been clean-shaven, but his face had so many minor topological features that it looked like a very bad example of slash-and-burn agriculture.
"Oh, dear," added the footman. He pulled himself together. "The other visitors normally just have cards."
Nobby produced a battered deck.
"I'm probably busy hobnobbing right now," he said, "but I'm game for a few rounds of Cripple Mr. Runyon afterwards, if you like."
The footman looked him up and down. He didn't get out much. He'd heard rumours, who hadn't, that working in the watch was the rightful king of Ankh-Morpork. He'd have to admit that if you wanted to hide a secret heir to the throne, you couldn't possibly hide him more carefully than under the face of C.W. St. J. Nobbs. On the other hand, the footman was something of an historian, and knew that in its long history even the throne itself had been occupied by creatures who had been hunchbacked, one-eyed, knuckle-dragging, and as ugly as sin. On that basis, Nobby was as royal as they came. If, technically, he wasn't hunchbacked, this was only because he was hunched front and sides, too. There might be a time, the footman thought, when it paid to hitch your wagon to a star, even if said star was a red dwarf.
"You've never been to one of these affairs before, milord," he said.
"First time," said Nobby. "I'm sure your lordship's blood will rise to the occasion," said the footman, weakly.
"I'll have to go," Angua thought as they hurried through the fog. "I can't go on living from month to month. It's not that he's not likeable. You couldn't wish to meet a more caring man.
That's just it. He cares for everyone. He cares about everything. He cares indiscriminately. He knows everything about everyone because everyone interests him. And the caring is all general and never personal.
He doesn't think personal is the same as important. If only he had some decent human quality like selfishness. I'm sure he doesn't think about it that way, but you can tell the werewolf thing is upsetting him underneath. He cares about the things people say behind my back, and he doesn't know how to deal with them. What was it those dwarfs said the other day? One said something like, 'She feels the need,' and the other one said, 'Yeah, the need to feed.' I saw his expression. I can handle that sort of thing, well, most of the time, but he can't. If only he'd thump someone. It wouldn't do any good, but at least he'd feel better. It's going to get worse. At best, I'm going to get caught in someone's chicken house, and then the midden is really going to hit the windmill. Or I'll get caught in someone's room." She tried to shut out the thought, but it didn't work. You could only control the werewolf. You couldn't tame it.
"It's the city. Too many people, too many smells. Maybe it would work if we were just alone somewhere. But if I said, 'It's me or the city,' he wouldn't even see there was a choice. Sooner or later, I've got to go home. It's the best thing for him."
Vimes walked back through the damp night. He knew he was too angry to think properly. He'd got nowhere, and he'd travelled a long way to get there. He'd got a cartload of facts, and he'd done all the right logical things, and to someone somewhere he must look like a fool. He probably looked like a fool to Carrot already. He'd kept coming up with bright ideas, proper policeman's ideas, and each one had turned out to be a joke. He'd bullied and shouted and done all the proper things, and none of it had worked. They hadn't found a thing. They'd merely increased their amount of ignorance. The ghost of old Mrs. Easy rose up in his inner vision. He couldn't remember much about her. He'd been just another snotty kid in a crowd of snotty kids, and she'd been just another worried face somewhere on top of a pinny. One of Cockbill Street's people. She'd taken in needlework to make ends meet and kept up appearances, and, like everyone else in the street, had crept through life, never asking for anything, and getting even less. What else could he have done? They'd practically scraped the damn wallpaper off the walls. He stopped. There was the same wallpaper in both rooms, in every room on that floor, that horrible green wallpaper. But no, that couldn't be it. Vetinari had slept in that room for years, if he slept at all. You can't sneak in and redecorate without someone noticing. In front of him, the fog rolled aside. He caught a glimpse of a candlelit room in a nearby building before the cloud flowed back. The fog. Yes, dampness. Creeping in, brushing against the wallpaper. The old, dusty, musty wallpaper. Would Cheery have tested the wallpaper? After all, in a way, you didn't actually see it. It wasn't in the room, because it was defining what the room was. Could you actually be poisoned by the walls?
He hardly dared think the thought. If he let his mind settle on the suspicion, it'd twist and fly away like all the others. But this was it, said his secret soul. All the messing around with suspects and clues, that was just something to keep the body amused while the back of the brain toiled away. Every real copper knew you didn't go around looking for clues so that you could find out who'd done it. No, you started out with a pretty good idea of who'd done it. That way, you knew what clues to look for. He wasn't going to have another day of bafflement interspersed with desperately bright ideas, was he? It was bad enough looking at Corporal Littlebottom's expression, which seemed to be getting a little more colourful every time he saw it. He'd said, "Ah, arsenic's a metal, right, so maybe the cutlery has been made of it." He wouldn't forget the look on the dwarf's face, as Cheery tried to explain that, yes, it might be possible to do that, provided you were sure that no one would notice the way it dissolved in the soup almost instantly. This time, he was going to think first.
The Hearl of Honk, Corporal the Right Honourable Lord C. W. St. J. Nobbs.
The buzz of conversation stopped. Heads turned. Somewhere in the crowd someone started to laugh and was hurriedly shushed into silence by their neighbours.
Lady Selachi came forward. She was a tall, angular woman with the sharp features and aquiline nose that were the hallmarks of the family. The impression was that an axe was being thrown at you. Then she curtsied. There were gasps of surprise around her, but she glared at the assembled guests, and there was a smattering of bows and curtsies. Somewhere at the back of the room someone started to say, "But the man's an absolute oik," and was cut off. "Has someone dropped something?" said Nobby, nervously. "I'll help you look, if you like."
The footman appeared at his elbow, bearing a tray.
"He drink, milord," he said.
"Yeah, okay, a pint of Winkles," said Nobby.
Jaws fell, but Lady Selachi's rose to the occasion.
"Winkles," she said. "He type of beer, your ladyship," said the footman.
Her ladyship hesitated only a moment.
"I believe the butler drinks beer," she said. "See to it, man, and I'll have a pint of Winkles too. What a novel idea!"
This caused a certain effect among those guests who knew on which side of the biscuit their pâté was spread.
"Indeed. Capital suggestion. A pint of Winkles here, too. Ho, ho, ho! Oh, great! Winkles for me! Winkles all round! But the man's an absolute tyke. Shut up!"
Vimes crossed the brass bridge with care, counting the hippos. There was a ninth shape, but it was leaning against the parapet and muttering to itself in a familiar, and to Vimes at least, an unmenacing way. Faint air movements wafted towards him a smell that outsmelled even the river. It proclaimed that ahead of Vimes was a ding-a-ling so big he'd been upgraded to a clang-a-lang.
"Bugger it. Oh, I told him. Stand it up and pull the end off, Millennium End and Shrimp. I told him. Oh, says I. And would they poke?"
"Evening, Ron," said Vimes, without even bothering to look at the figure. Foul old Ron fell into step behind him.
"Bugger it. They done me out of it, so they did."
"Yes, Ron," said Vimes.
"And Shrimp, bugger it, I say. Oh, bread it on the butter side. Ooh, Queen Molly says to watch your back, mister."
"What was that?"
"Souter fry it," said foul old Ron innocently. "Trouser the lot of them if they did me out of it. Them and their big weasel."
The beggar lurched around, and filthy coat dragging its hems along the ground, limped away into the fog. His little dog trotted along in front of him. There was pandemonium in the servants' hall.
"Winkle's old peculiar," said the butler.
"Another 104 pints," said the footman.
The butler shrugged.
"Harry, Sid, Rob and Geoffrey, two trays apiece and double down to the King's Head again right now. What else is he doing?"
"Well, they're supposed to be having a poetry reading, but he's telling them jokes."
"Anecdotes?"
"Not exactly."
It was amazing how it could drizzle and fog at the same time. Wind was blowing both through the open window, and Vimes was forced to shut it. He lit the candles by his desk and opened his notebook. Probably he should use the demonic organizer, but he likes to see things written down fair and square. He could think better when he wrote things down. He wrote, "Arsenic," and drew a big circle round it. Around the circle he wrote,
Father Tubalcek's fingernails, and rats, and veterinari, and Mrs. Easy. Lower down the page he wrote golems, and drew a second circle. Around that one he wrote Father Tubalcek, and Mr. Hopkinson. After some thought he wrote down stolen clay, and grog, and then why would a golem admit to something it didn't do? He stared at the candlelight for a while and then wrote, rats eat stuff. More time passed. What has the priest got that anyone wants? From downstairs came the sound of armour as a patrol came in. A corporal shouted. Words, wrote Vimes. What had Mr. Hopkinson got? Dwarf bread? Arrow not stolen. What else had he got? Vimes looked at this too, and then he wrote, bakery, stared at the word for a while, and rubbed it out, and replaced it with oven. He drew a ring around oven, and a ring around stolen clay, and linked the two. There'd been arsenic under the old priest's fingernails. Perhaps he'd put down rat poison. There were plenty of uses for arsenic. It wasn't as if you couldn't buy it by the pound from any alchemist. He wrote down arsenic monster, and looked at it. You found dirt under fingernails. If people had put up a fight, you might find blood or skin. You didn't find grease and arsenic. He looked at the page again, and after still more thought, wrote, golems aren't alive, but they think they are alive. What do things that are alive do? Arrow. Answer. Breathe, eat, crap. He paused, staring out at the fog, and then wrote very carefully, and make more things. Something tingled at the back of his neck. He circled the late Hopkinson's name and drew a line down the page to another circle in which he wrote, he'd got a big oven. Cheery had said you couldn't bake clay properly in a bread oven, but maybe you could bake it improperly. He looked up at the candlelight again. They couldn't do that, could they? Oh, gods, no, surely not. But after all you needed was clay, and a holy man who knew how to write the words, and someone to actually sculpt the figure, Vimes supposed. But golems had hundreds and hundreds of years to learn to be good with their hands. Those great big hands. The ones that looked so very fist-like. And then the first thing they'd want to do would be to destroy the evidence, wouldn't they? They probably didn't think of it as killing, but more like a sort of switching off. He drew another rather misshapen circle on his notes. Grog, old baked clay, ground up small. They'd added some of their own clay. Dorfel had a new foot, didn't he? It? It hadn't made it quite right. They'd put part of their own selves into a new golem. That all sounded, well, Nobby would call it mucky. Vimes didn't know what to call it. It sounded like some sort of secret society thing. Clay of my clay, my own flesh and blood. Damn hulking things, aping their betters. Vimes yawned. Sleep. He'd be better for some sleep. Or something. He stared at the page. Automatically, his hand trailed down to the bottom drawer of his desk, as it always did when he was worried and trying to think. It wasn't as though there was ever a bottle there these days, but old habits died hard. There was a soft, glassy ching and a faint, seductive slosh. Vimes's hand came up with a fat bottle. The label said, Beer Huggers Distilleries, the Macabre Finest Malt. The liquid inside almost crawled up the sides of the glass in anticipation. He stared at it. He'd reached down into the drawer for the whiskey bottle, and there it was. But it shouldn't have been. He knew Carrot and Fred Colan kept an eye on him, but he'd never bought a bottle since he'd got married, because he'd promised Sybil, hadn't he? But this wasn't any old rot-gut. This was the Macabre. He'd tried it once. He couldn't quite remember why now, since in those days the only spirits he generally drank had the subtlety of a mallet to the inner ear. He must have found the money somehow. Just a sniff of it had been like Hogswatch night. Just a sniff.